Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and it's the 7th of January, and you're listening to the AR Library Q&A call. Here's our first question for the day, and this is our first one for the new year, so welcome, everyone. Rick, I have a number of questions, so I'll start with the old one and add a few to the list just as I just don't understand. History. My wife and I have been together 20 years, married 10. 3.5 years ago, she told me that she had been unfaithful during our living together period with two people, both of which were brief encounters. More information keeps coming out, and eventually she admits that she had an affair 6 months after we were married and has not done it since. Needless to say, I was devastated. I kept thinking that there was more, but all she continued to say is it was 7 years ago and she really didn't remember much other than the approximate time period, the person, and a smidgen of information. I wanted more, but there wasn't any. I asked all kinds of questions, from details to high level, but she insisted she could not remember hardly any of it. I resorted to creating a fake Facebook account and other tactics and got in touch with two of these people and found out information that was shocking. The more I looked, the more I found. It was horrifying. I spent months collecting information and putting the pieces together. It turns out my wife had an inappropriate relationship from the moment we met until 6 months after we were married. I had so many triggers, even our wedding pictures, I took them down, hoping one day I'd be able to look at them again. Realizing an impact on me, the potential loss of a cherished memory, the wedding, she suddenly told me that she had a dream and wasn't sure if it happened before we were married or after. She swore that it wouldn't make a difference and insisted both were equally wrong. I knew she didn't feel that way and pressed her to tell the truth. People remember if they're with someone before or after their wedding. Our therapist agreed, but this went on for the 3+ years. I couldn't move on until she accepted responsibility. I was consumed with proving it to her. Eventually, I found the proof. She had deluded herself, that it may not have happened. In time, I believed her. Ironically, I'm the only one. I didn't expect her to remember the color of her nail polish, but some high-level things had to be part of her memory, right? Even finding out incidents that occurred that because of the unusual location, think Mile High Club, while she was may not have included it on her list initially when confronted, you'd expect that person to say, "Yep, I did that, but not my wife." She has me convinced her memory issues are real. As such, I'm very concerned that her ability to delude herself of practically anything that serves her purpose or protects her ego control cannot be fixed by a course like this, and there's a much larger problem that needs to be addressed. I've read countless articles on memory loss, suppression, repression, motivated forgetting, and much more. I'm worried that a larger problem exists here that won't be addressed by an EMS 911 course. Anyone who can delude themselves into really believing things did not happen has a larger issue here, right? And I would agree that someone who has that sort of memory loss would have a larger issue. At the same time, I think you'll find the reason many people have a memory problem is it's a defense mechanism. In other words, denial is really one of God's greatest gifts to us. Oftentimes, what we've done is so what's called ego dystonic. It's so against who we are that it's more than we can bear if we were to really look at it, so our subconscious mind shuts it out. Sometimes in a course like this, which detoxifies the shame that's created by the infidelity, when you can detoxify that shame, they find that things will begin to come back to mind, that memories will begin to release because it feels safe enough. For many people, they've got to have safe people to talk to before they'll get to that place where they'll even remember. So I'm hoping as you go through the course, you'll find that she feels safe enough to be able to come clean. But more than that, a lot of the shame associated with what she's done will actually begin to go away. And as that shame decreases, then the probabilities of her being able to remember will increase. Now for our next question. I was forced to piece together an 11-year period of infidelity that had both hot and cold periods, different people, and spanned 11 years, including our dating and living together engagement, and within the first year of our marriage. My entire history, even every vacation, holiday, minor and major events, has bookends of betrayal. My wife didn't want to admit the magnitude of the betrayal, so I had to endure an incredibly painful, arduous, and long process to prove it to her. Every new element was questioned and met with denial. I am obsessive by nature, but this made things so much worse, and we couldn't move towards healing since she wouldn't admit nor be accountable for what she had done. She's finally ready now. I love her dearly and have forgiven her for what she had done, although I'm devastated at times and get angry and have to recommit to forgiveness. Many times I find myself more upset with what I perceive as a betrayal in the recovery process than in the infidelity. I could go on and on about my hurt in this area, but I'll focus on my question now. I don't want to know everything. I'll never know. The more digging I do, the more I find, and I know enough to understand what happened. And now she's at a point where she sees it too. And that's all I ever wanted. It's the why that confuses me in chapter two of our workbooks. Should it be about her reasoning at the time and what was going on inside of her head? Should it include all the defense mechanisms like rationalization, justification, and the other details on how she made these decisions as she remembers them? Should it be about her childhood coming from a divorce rather than divorced father and the impact it had on her behavior and personality? Should it be on her lack of investment and selfishness and even higher true reasons for her actions? I could go on and on. What exactly should be included in the why? All the above? Please help us understand. We have finally come to accept what has happened without the need to get to everything. If we understand the why, we hope to identify the behavior and the source of the problem and work on a plan to change our cognitive thinking behaviors. Help us understand the why. That's a difficult question, and I think it's probably a little bit of all of the above. For me to answer the why, it's almost like you have to know the person and talk with them a lot. Each of us has our own nuances as to why we do things. I think that it's interesting, as I understand, this is something that happened a number of years ago, and what's more interesting to me is why she stopped and how did things within her shift to the point to where it was no longer a problem. But every why that you just mentioned, I think, is a piece. In the Hope for Healing course, I don't know if she's taken that or not. We actually spend several weeks talking about why and trying to help people begin to look at their justifications that they used. What were the pieces that they picked up from their childhood and their family of origin that would have created this? What was their own self-loathing and self-contempt that would allow them to treat themselves that way? I think those are all important. It sounds to me, if you're working together, it wasn't a matter of her not wanting to be with you. It sounds like probably more of an habit or an addictive process that she was involved in. It's interesting, I have trouble thinking of her as being addicted simply because she was able to stop so thoroughly. Like I said, my bigger question is, how did she stop? Even though I'm very grateful that she did. So if she wants more in depth onto why, first I'd suggest that maybe she do individual counseling, or that she take the Hope for Healing course. And as she talks with some of the other women, I think she may be able to figure out the answer to some of the whys. Certainly, things that predispose us come from childhood, things our parents did. They also come from our belief systems. In fact, something else that's interesting, if a woman has sex at 15 or younger, their first sexual experience, 47% of those women will actually end up being unfaithful, while if someone's first sexual experience is after 21, then only 17% of those women tend to be unfaithful. So, you know, just how you grew up has a lot to do with it. If you want to be evaluated for why, then maybe you could call Crossroads Counseling and I could talk to her and see if we could figure it out from that direction. But that's a very, very difficult question. But I hope as you work through the course that maybe you'll get some of those answers. I understand why the why question is important, simply because it's hard to know whether it's safe and you can keep it from happening again without that information. So I would continue to encourage you to pursue it, but understand there are so many different layers to why. In my own recovery, I think I've spent 27 years trying to discover some of the whys. And maybe I see new pieces all the time. I don't know if that is a helpful answer for you, but I just continue on your journey. I do hope you'll do that. So for our next question. Long ago, before we married, my wife and I made a deal that we would raise our future children Jewish. I had a bar mitzvah, but was not a believer and did not feel comfortable with religion. My wife loves being Jewish. It's a sense of pride and history and identity and tradition and values, among a great many other things. Well, this is one of those black and white areas where I agree that her request, knowing that in marriage or a relationship, sometimes you have to go the path of your partner. We have kids. Strangely, as we fed them, they grew and they grew. Suddenly, they were little people, and not just some fictional characters discussed in a theory a long time ago. I suddenly became aware that my belief system was not going to be shared with our children. My wife and I had a deal, yet I felt like a hypocrite, a phony, pretending to support something I did not believe at all. It didn't seem fair. I was angry at the situation. My wife knew how I felt and told me I could certainly share my beliefs with the children at the right time, but now wasn't the right time. It'd be confusing to the kids. Translation, you can tell them what you want after their indoctrination process is complete. I could have gotten angry and blamed her. I could have broken our deal and told the kids what I believed, regardless of my wife's feelings about me doing so. Instead of confronting her, I gave the matter some deep thought. You see, compromise, black or white issues, on black and white issues, don't have to be a win-lose situation. Everything is a matter of how you process and what you choose to believe. There are no truths except in math. The rest are truths that we choose to accept or can hurt us or help us. I finally came to a truth that served me, my children, and my wife. My reasoning. My wife loves being Jewish. She loves God. Her faith allows her to feel a connection to people, all living things, and it's something that fills her with life and joy. If my children had a great teacher like their mother, unlike my religious upbringing, and she was able to give all of these wonderful things to them which could enrich their lives, I had to ask myself, what's wrong with that? So, there you have it. I found a truth and did not require my wife to assist in the problem. The truth that was not a negative, not a compromise, bad word, but a truth. I fully support and believe it happily. I guess what I'm trying to say is this. When it comes to needs being met, differences of opinion, arguments over the ridiculous, no matter how difficult the problem, perception is always the answer, and finding a truth that serves us, not me, is always available if we look at the right situation in the right way. I couldn't agree more. Thank you. Now for our next question. First and foremost, I love your website, articles, philosophy, and now the EMS course. Everything makes sense, unlike our therapy, which had zero structure and provided little value, possibly due to choosing a therapist that wasn't right for us. But that's another story. This chapter had a lot of good information, as always, but I was consistently at odds with it. First, you reference the three idiot lights, guilt, fear, and shame, pointing out these emotions are warning signs and indicators that her is not on the right path, is super insight. Its meaning is to get us to stop in our tracks and think differently. I get it. These feelings will never serve us and can only do us harm. And knowledge/awareness is power. However, having read numerous articles and books on cognitive thinking, I'm worried that the knowing is only part of the equation and the mind has to be retrained to process information differently. There doesn't seem to be any information about how to properly cognitively change your behavior. Knowledge is one step, certainly, but doing something that with that knowledge is equally important. Without this, it's a sandwich without meat. You go on to discuss what is marriage. Very clever. And in some cases, I agree with the content. However, I have a major problem with accepting what you're saying here. The second law of thermodynamics, you never get more out of something you put into it. You really cannot get as much as you put into it. As a philosophy major many moons ago, Aristotle wrote, "The whole is greater than the sum of the parts." As a marriage, I am she is her, and we have this new element, us. If I were to give someone hints, I would put it thought and time in a course, of course, a service product or something like quality time. Giving feels good, hence, I get something. The person will likely feel good, and the cycle will assume that they give something back. Hence, for my one generosity, I now have more than one. My own good feelings and something new from the person I gave something to. I got a lot of satisfaction from my marriage. Pride, identity, and things from both my wife as well as myself. You go on to only focus about needs in this section and others. I believe much in life is a matter of perception. Oftentimes we focus on what we perceive we need but don't have. If we have the proper mindset, we realize we are negating all the needs that are being met that we take for granted and the needs we perceive that are not being and truly met if we look at it in the proper way. In All People Are Scum, you talk about people wanting what they don't have. Again, perception. Any mature human being would understand what they don't have lacks in other areas, even if we don't see that initially. Nothing is perfect, and yes, we are responsible for our own needs, and no one can ever fully meet our needs. I just don't think this is what marriage is at all, certainly not as I ever viewed it. Since I don't subscribe to any one religion, the idea that God created marriage to make us miserable is a clever spin. But I understand that the idea of marriage isn't about getting your needs met, but rather about making us better people through humility and selflessness. I still believe in love, romance, and my soulmate. In short, but truly long, I suppose I felt like the entire chapter was filled with common sense and has always appreciated. Not enough information, though, about cognitive behavior, i.e. what to do with the warning signs and a viewpoint about marriage that makes sense, but really should focus on changing one's perception to a truth that serves the greater good. Thank you for your ear. I love the feedback. Thank you very, very much, Jeff. And I think in the thermodynamics, the first thing I wanted to say is really my main point. And I agree with Aristotle, and I agree in synergy. So it's not that's not the point. To me, it's just when people get married and make the assumption that things will just work out in a marriage, they set themselves up for a lot of trouble. In the long run, I feel like people desperately need to make investments in their marriage to keep it alive and well. And I think it's a tragedy when people assume that everything will just work out. And so I want to encourage people to continue giving. Second, it's interesting. I am primarily a cognitive therapist. So I know that in this particular chapter, I probably haven't covered a lot cognitively about what to do with those idiot lights, and I appreciate that feedback, and we'll make sure that we make changes to reflect that. And I really appreciate one last thing, which is how you translate things into your own life and use them. Thank you. I mean, to me, you're doing a really good job, and I hope that you and your wife do well. Thanks for all the questions and the feedback you've been giving. I really do appreciate it. Now for our next question. I am 18 months from D-Day, 7 months from my husband's commitment to marriage. He fell in love with a good friend of mine, and the affair lasted 5 years. He's repentant, but now wants to do recovery in his way and not be controlled, which means allowing the AP to keep her job. He is her boss. I'm weary of doing most of the work and now in the releasing phase. Can you talk more about the releasing phase to allow the partner to do his own recovery without nagging and while still living together? And how does one reattach after detaching? I think it's incredibly difficult when someone has to live in a situation where their mate continues to work with their AP, largely because it's such a trigger. One of the things you don't say here is how much this is bothering you. I know that you're only 7 months from your husband's commitment to the marriage, and hopefully he is truly detached from her. But the other thing that I kind of think of, even at 18 months from D-Day, it doesn't sound like recovery began till about 7 months ago, which makes this incredibly difficult. Sometimes I would tell people that you've got about as long to get over it as your husband had to actually be in the affair. And, you know, in this sort of situation, 7 months, again, is not very far into this process. The problem with releasing and letting him work his own recovery is it's got to make you feel vulnerable, and that's why the 7 months isn't very long. If you had a much longer period of time where nothing had gone on, in particular where he still wasn't in her presence, I think that process would be easier. But for your own journey, it would seem to me that releasing is not a bad idea when it comes to letting him work that recovery. You'll learn later in the course that sometimes relapse is a really necessary component for change. And potentially, if he thinks nothing's going to happen, it may be that the only way he comes to an understanding that this is bigger than he thought would be to start down that slippery slope again. Not that I would want that for him. That's something he's got to discover. And as you understand, you cannot be his motivation for doing this. It's very difficult to reattach after detaching if it still doesn't feel safe. I will tell you that safety is almost always the biggest key. And if there are other things he can do to make you feel safe that's not being done, then you might suggest to see if he would help with those things. If he's willing to give you that, you might find that that alone is enough to help you be able to begin to move forward and reattach. I'm not quite sure in your question if you're saying that you've detached already. It's going to be empathy. And ultimately, you're knowing that he cares about you and that you matter to him and he's concerned for you that will make it safe. And I only hope that he comes to that place where he can communicate that to you, and hopefully that'll happen through the course and you'll get to a place to where you can trust, but you'll never know whether or not he'll fly until you let go. One of the things of changing habits, if you go back and read the habit series, is you're going to have to focus on something different. The time that you've spent looking and kind of checking or those sorts of behaviors, you're going to have to find other things to focus on. During your high-risk times, you might want to chart those to find out when it's most difficult and find something else to do. Reading, giving to others, staying busy with painting or whatever works for you, but staying active will be something else. And I think life-giving activities for you will be something that may also help. So the next question. The website says every Monday at 12 noon, but my reminder email said 8 a.m. Central Standard. I got this call at 8 a.m. I tried again at 10 p.m. So the question is, where was I? I apologize. I was out of the office today, so I'm doing them now delayed. And I will try to do better next week. Next question. Hi, Rick. I have a question about privacy. Recently, my husband became very angry with me because I went through his phone and car. We were supposed to be reconciling. However, due to the events that happened, I don't think this will ever happen now. His phone was with me, and I went through it. I told him I did, and I found out he said some pretty hurtful words about me, and he contacted his AP the night he moved back home and told her he was staying with a friend. He told me I was wrong in going through his phone. I was just being nosy. I had never gone through any of his stuff prior to his affair, ever. I never had a reason to. Now I'm told I'm just searching and nosy. That is not true. He's gone again because I told him to go with her. I don't know if there's a chance or not. So much has been done. Anyway, can you post something about the rules of privacy of the unfaithful? I would appreciate it. God bless. Well, to me, the rules of privacy for the faithful and the unfaithful are about the same. I think that especially when this is going on, there needs to be fidelity, not infidelity. I even recommend at times that if someone spent a lot of money on an affair partner, that they give their mate that amount of money to, you know, check all they want to. They want to hire a PI to make sure and confirm everything's okay. They ought to be able to do that. Certainly, giving access to emails, to phones, to cars, there doesn't need to be anything hidden. It is natural to want to check and to know that it's safe. Before you can begin to reconcile, you first have to establish that there's safety in the relationship. And there's no way that someone's going to trust automatically just because someone says, trust me. So my recommendation is that both parties agree that there's going to be openness, that there's no hidden emails, that there is passwords are given. Now, I will say there's one exception. We all need safe people to talk to. And I think it's very important for people to have a place of privacy where it is safe to talk, to vent, to process. 'Cause in processing, like journaling, it's not always true. So if someone's on like Hope for Healing or Harboring Hope, where they're doing their individual work or with a therapist, those situations to me need to be private so someone is able to kind of work through their feelings to get down to what the truth is without having to write for their mate or the fear that ultimately their mate's going to read what they've written. But full openness to me is exactly what happens once a couple goes into recovery. And I can tell you the only reason your mate's defensive in this situation is because he got caught and he's guilty. And it's probably a good thing you ask him to leave. In the future when he comes back, if he's not broken and willing to be known, and willing to be intimate with you, you can know that it's not safe to continue on in the relationship. Without that safety, healing doesn't occur. So I want to thank everybody for joining the call today. I want to wish you all a happy new year and look forward to talking to you on the call next week to healing.